Hi, my name is Dave Emery. This is For the Record program number 1017. Supreme Court Trump card. Family Trump, Family Kennedy, and Peter Thiel. This is being recorded on July 31st of the year 2018. There has been a lot of discussion, of course, of Donald Trump's new Supreme Court appointee, Judge Brett Kavanaugh, and that appointment is to fill the vacancy left by Anthony Kennedy, who announced his retirement. And what we're going to be doing in this program is to take a look at some deep networking. We are going to be taking a look at some numerous and profound links between Team Trump and the Trump family and people connected to Judge Anthony Kennedy. People who had clerked for Anthony Kennedy have figured prominently in the judicial appointments made by Donald Trump, of the nominations by Donald Trump. And beyond that, there are some significant links between the Kennedy family, specifically between Anthony Kennedy's sons, Justin Kennedy and Gregory Kennedy, and people affiliated with both the Trump family and Donald Trump himself, and with what we could call Team Trump, including and especially Peter Thiel, the arguably the most important of Donald Trump's Silicon Valley connections, a person we have spoken about at great length in the past. Some of that discussion we will reprise in this program. In turn, I think the discussion in which we will be engaging in this program also needs to be placed within the context of some deeper networking, deeper political and financial / commercial networking that really is relevant to the discussion. I know people have grown accustomed to writing off a lot of very important, albeit not well-known and very inconvenient political associations as conspiracy theory. We are going to be taking a look at some deep political and economic connections between Team Trump and people and institutions looming large in the background of the discussion here, and what I call the underground, right? Specifically, financial and industrial interests that were affiliated with the Third Reich in its above-ground manifestation, and which have continued to network with or are inextricably linked to the underground Reich and the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, about which I have spoken so often. The institution, I believe, will prove to be the decisive element in human affairs on this planet. By the way, people have, over the years, taken me to task for saying that. They say, well, you shouldn't say that they will prove to be the decisive element. It is not something I enjoy or that I would optimally like to see. That is what I think will happen. And the older you get, and I'm getting up there, as they say, you realize the importance, at least for me, of telling the truth and providing accurate analysis and not playing games. I'm not a cheerleader. I don't think I look very good in one of those little pleated skirts. And what I am interested in here is telling the truth, and I believe that is what is going to happen. It is not what I would like to happen. It's what I think will happen. The world does not belong to me, and I'm a very small part of it, and what I am trying to do is to tell the truth and present accurate analysis, and I believe that is what is going to happen, and I believe that is what is happening, is a triumph of the Third Reich, albeit in its underground phase. It is now coming above ground. Just take a look at what is happening in Austria and places like that. The underground Reich in places like Austria, Ukraine, and elsewhere is becoming the overground Reich once again. And it's not a Fourth Reich. It is an extension of the Third, which I believe will prove to be decisive in the affairs of our species on this planet. One of the things that we are going to be doing is looking at Deutsche Bank. That was the largest and most important financial institution of Germany in the early Hitler and during the main Hitler phases, and is one of the most important elements of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. Hermann Obst, the head of Deutsche Bank, was arguably Hitler's most important banker, perhaps behind Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, his finance minister at one point. And Hermann Obst has played a decisive role in not only Deutsche Bank, but the Vatican as well. It would be impossible to exaggerate the role of Deutsche Bank, both with the above-ground Third Reich and with the Bormann Organization and the Bormann Flight Capital Network. As we looked at in For the Record 919, and I'm going to briefly quote from a linked New York Times article that we read at some length, in For the Record 919, about Deutsche Bank being the most important financial backer of Donald Trump's real estate ventures. While many big banks have shunned him, Deutsche Bank AG has been a steadfast financial backer of the Republican presidential candidate's business interests. Since 1998, the bank has led or participated in loans of at least $2.5 billion to companies affiliated with Mr. Trump, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of public records and people familiar with the matter. That does not include at least another $1 billion in loan commitments that Deutsche Bank made to Trump-affiliated entities. The long-standing connection makes Frankfurt-based Deutsche Bank, which has a large U.S. operation and has been grappling with reputational problems and an almost 50% stock price decline, the financial institution with probably the strongest ties to the controversial New York businessman. And that, again, from the New York Times article linked in the description for the Record 1017 that will become public, presently, shortly after the recording of this program. Now, reviewing a couple of excerpts from the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, of Deutsche Bank, its role in the Bormann Flight Capital Network, or part of it. We read on page 139, when Bormann gave the order for his representatives to resume purchases of American corporate stocks, it was usually done through the neutral countries of Switzerland and Argentina. From foreign exchange funds on deposit in Swiss banks and in Deutsche Südamerikanische Bank, the Buenos Aires branch of Deutsche Bank, large demand deposits were placed in the principal money center banks of New York City, National City, now Citibank, now this is from the book published in 1981, now Citicorp, Chase Manhattan, now Chase Manhattan N.A., Manufacturers and Hanover, now Manufacturers Hanover Trust, Morgan Guaranty, and Irving Trust. Such deposits are interest-free, and the banks can invest this money as they wish, thus turning tidy profits for themselves. In return, they provide reasonable services such as the purchase of stocks and transfer or payment of money on demand by customers of Deutsche Bank, such as representatives of the Bormann business organizations and Martin Bormann himself, who has demand accounts in three New York City banks. They continue to do so. The German investment in American corporations from these sources exceeded $5 billion and made the Bormann economic structure a web of power and influence. The two German-owned banks of Spain, Banco Alemán Transatlántico, now named Banco Comercial Transatlántico, and Banco Germánico de la América del Sur, S.A., a subsidiary of Deutsche Bank, served to channel German money from Spain to South America, where further investments were made. Deutsche Bank and the Bormann Network have links that could, well, very profound links. This is only one of them, and this has to do with Deutsche Bank's service provided to the Bormann Network of providing a financial reservoir for Bormann business investment in the U.S., in particular, the purchases of blue-chip American corporate stocks. Bormann himself, again, had demand accounts in three New York City banks. From page 205, we read, the FBI file on Martin Bormann revealed that he had been banking under his own name from his office in Germany in Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires since 1941, that he held one joint account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, and on August 4th, 5th, and 14th of 1967, had written checks on demand accounts in First National City Bank Overseas Division of New York, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company, all of which cleared through Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires. The official lie, and that is just what it is, that Martin Bormann died in 1945, I think, is rather effectively disproved by that. Not only is the alleged DNA evidence, which has never been revealed, altogether tainted, the alleged evidence of Bormann's death just has never really been vetted. Banking records are incredibly good documentation, and these banking records from the FBI file on Martin Bormann. I find very interesting that the three checks that were written here were on August 4th, August 5th, and August 14th of 1967. One of the things that we spoke about in For the Record 305, talking about the Bormann Network, was how the Bormann Network and Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, worked with the CIA and U.S. intelligence. In fact, there is a For the Record program called the Heinrich Müller File, talking about Mueller's post-war work with U.S. intel. August 4th, 5th, and 14th of 67 is not very long before April and June of 1968, though that is when Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated. I have often wondered if there might be a link between these checks written in August of 67 and the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy in April and June of the following year. Were these, in fact, providing some financial platforms for that operation or those operations? I don't know, but it is interesting to contemplate.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com. Also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Now, we are going to talk about profound links between the Kennedy family and not only Donald Trump, but his family and the real estate ventures of both Donald Trump and Jared Kushner, his son-in-law who was married to Ivanka Trump. We also are going to talk about the profound links between people who had clerked before Anthony Kennedy, when they were moving up through the judicial hierarchy, and people who have either been nominated and succeeded or been approved for judicial appointments or are awaiting confirmation. A New York Times story from June 28th of 2018, inside the White House's quiet campaign to create a Supreme Court opening. This by Adam Liptak, L-I-P-T-A-K as in kangaroo, and Maggie with two G's, Haberman, H-A-B-E-R-M-A-N, from the New York Times of June 28th of 2018. President Trump singled him out for praise even while attacking other members of the Supreme Court. The White House nominated people close to him to important judicial posts, and members of the Trump family forged personal connections. We'll see what those were in a minute. Their goal was to assure Justice Anthony M. Kennedy that his judicial legacy would be in good hands should he step down at the end of the court's term ended this week, as he was rumored to be considering. Parenthetically, he did just that. Allies of the White House were more blunt, warning the 81-year-old justice that time was of the essence. There was no telling, they said, what would happen if Democrats gained control of the Senate after the November elections and had the power to block the president's choice as his successor. Skipping down. When Mr. Trump took office last year, he already had a Supreme Court vacancy to fill, the one created by the 2016 death of Justice Antonin Scalia. But Mr. Trump dearly wanted a second vacancy, one that could transform the court for a generation or more. So he used the first opening to help create the second. He picked Justice Neil M. Gorsuch, who had served as a law clerk to Justice Kennedy, to fill Justice Scalia's seat. Again, note that Neil Gorsuch, now sitting on the Supreme Court, clerked with Anthony Kennedy, skipping down. Then, after Justice Gorsuch's nomination was announced, a White House official singled out two candidates for the next Supreme Court vacancy. Judge Brett M. Kavanaugh of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, and Judge Raymond M. Kethledge, K-E-T-H-L-E-D-G-E, of the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in Cincinnati. The two judges had something in common. They had both clerked for Justice Kennedy, like Neil Gorsuch. Of course, Judge Kavanaugh got the nomination. In the meantime, as the White House turned to stocking the lower courts, it did not overlook Justice Kennedy's clerks. Mr. Trump nominated three of them to federal appeals courts, Judges Stefanos, Bibas, B-I-B-A-S, and Michael Scudder, S-C-U-D-D-E-R, both of whom have been confirmed, and Eric Murphy, the Ohio Solicitor General, who Mr. Trump nominated to the Sixth Circuit this month. So again, summing up, Neil Gorsuch clerked with Anthony Kennedy. The two men mentioned as candidates for the next Supreme Court vacancy, Judge Kavanaugh, who has been nominated to replace Anthony Kennedy, and Judge Raymond M. Kethledge, both clerked for Anthony Kennedy as well. And three judges nominated for the appeals courts, Stefanos Bibas, Michael Scudder, and Eric Murphy, all had clerked for Anthony Kennedy as well, like Gorsuch, like Kavanaugh, who've been nominated or confirmed, and Judge Raymond Kethledge. And the connections between the Trumps and the Kennedys, that's Anthony Kennedy, go deeper still, skipping down. Mr. Trump, and this is a comment that he made offhandedly into an open mic, complimenting the son of Justice Anthony Kennedy. Mr. Trump was apparently referring to Justice Kennedy's son, Justin, J-U-S-T-I-N. The younger Mr. Kennedy spent more than a decade at Deutsche Bank, eventually rising to become the bank's global head of real estate capital markets. And he worked closely with Mr. Trump when he was a real estate developer, according to two people with knowledge of his role. During Mr. Kennedy's tenure, Deutsche Bank became Mr. Trump's most important lender, dispensing well over $1 billion in loans to him for the renovation and construction of skyscrapers in New York and Chicago at a time other mainstream banks were wary of doing business with him because of his troubled business history. The point being that Anthony Kennedy's son, Justin, became Deutsche Bank's global head of real estate capital markets, and he became the fellow who basically greased the financial wheels for Donald Trump. He was, in effect, Donald Trump's banker. A very, very important connection. And this was for Deutsche Bank, some of whose connections and history and foundations we have already spoken about. Now, after leaving Deutsche Bank, Justin Kennedy became the co-CEO of a company called LNR, that's Larry Nancy Robert Property, LLC, with a guy named Tobin Cobb. We're going to find out with whom they have been doing business here as well. From the Medium blog of March 1st of 2017, an article by Cesar, C-apostrophe-Z-A-R Bernstein, B-E-R-N-S-T-E-I-N, and Gabe Rusk, R-U-S-K. The Kennedy, Kushner, and Trump connection. A curious conversation and a business deal. And this reads in part as follows. Justice Anthony Kennedy has two very successful sons in their own right, Gregory and Justin Kennedy. Gregory Kennedy, a Stanford Law graduate, a Stanford man like his father, was named CEO of Disruptive Technology Advisors in October of 2016. More about him later. According to his LinkedIn page, Disruptive Technology Advisors is a Los Angeles-based merchant bank with an exclusive focus on mid- to late-stage growth companies. That's Gregory. We're going to talk about him later. Back to Justin Kennedy. Justin Kennedy, a graduate of UCLA and Stanford, again like his father, has spent his career in the world of banking, investment, and, interestingly, real estate. In particular, from 2010 to 2013, Justin Kennedy was the co-CEO of LNR Property LLC. One more time. In particular, from 2010 to 2013, this is after he left Deutsche Bank, where he was head of Deutsche Bank's global real estate investments, and as such presided over Deutsche Bank's largesse vis-a-vis Donald Trump at a time when other banks basically wouldn't touch him because he stank so badly. Then he goes to work for LNR Property, becoming the co-CEO. In particular, from 2010-2013, Justin Kennedy was the co-CEO of LNR Property LLC with Tobin Cobb, T-O-B-I-N-C-O-B-B. In the world of high-stakes New York real estate, it would be fairly improbable that the Trump or Kushner groups, monoliths in their own right, would not have mingled or done business with LNR at some point in time. We were not surprised, therefore, to discover that there is a likely connection. Likely, that's very, very charitable. Here is what we know. Jared Kushner, by the way, again, is Donald Trump's son-in-law, married to Ivanka Trump. They both are wielding great influence within the White House. According to the New York Times, in 2007, Kushner Companies purchased, quote, on the aluminum-clad office tower in Midtown Manhattan for a record price of $1.8 billion. At the time, the New York Times wrote that this deal was, quote, considered a classic example of reckless underwriting. The transaction was so highly leveraged that the cash flow from rents amounted to only 65% of the debt service. Again, this is 2007, before, actually it was about the time the real estate market was going south prior to the financial collapse of 2008, and that basically the going south, the southward migration of the real estate market was at the foundation of the financial collapse and the 2008 depression. More about Kushner Company's purchase of this Midtown Manhattan building, by the way, appropriate enough at 666 Fifth Avenue in New York City. A very ironic coincidence that, continuing. As many real estate specialists predicted, the Kushner purchase of 666 Fifth Avenue ran into trouble. Instead of rising, rents declined as the recession took hold and new leases were scarce. In 2010, the loan was transferred to a special servicer on the assumption that a default would occur once reserve funds were being used to subsidize the shortfall were bled dry. But the story may yet have a happy ending for Kushner, a family-owned business that moved its headquarters. No, excuse me, I fused a synapse. The aluminum-clad office tower was not 666 Fifth Avenue. That is the headquarters of the Kushner Real Estate Venture, beginning again. The story may yet have a happy ending for Kushner, a family-owned business that moved its headquarters from Florham Park, New Jersey, to 666 Fifth Avenue, its first major acquisition in Manhattan. The aluminum-clad office tower was not the first. Who came to the rescue of the Kushner property? None other than LNR Property, the company whose CEO at the time was Justin Kennedy. According to the New York Times and The Real Deal, Mr. Kushner and LNR reached a possible agreement with LNR Property, a firm specializing in restructuring troubled debt and which oversees the mortgage that will allow him to retain control of the tower by modifying terms of the $1.2 billion mortgage tied to the office portion of the building, unquote. A spokesman for Mr. Kushner told the Wall Street Journal in March of 2011 that, quote, the Kushners are ready and willing to invest more money into the property as soon as they can come to mutually satisfactory terms with the servicing agent, unquote. In that same article, Kushner's father-in-law and the future president commented on the negotiations with Justin Kennedy's company. Speaking about the deal, Trump told the Wall Street Journal that Kushner is, quote, a very smart young man. I think it, loan renegotiations, will come out well for him and everybody, unquote. At this point, there is no doubt that there was a direct business relationship between LNR and Kushner Companies at the time Justin Kennedy and Jared Kushner were both CEO. Even the future president was aware of the deal and commented on its respective merits. That being said, it is not impossible that Jared Kushner and Justin Kennedy did not meet in connection with the specific deal in question. However, given the stakes involved, it does seem more than likely that the two CEOs would have interacted as negotiations were being conducted. I would add, it would be one hell of a reach to assume that they hadn't. Continuing. The connections between Kushner, Kennedy, and Trump do not end there. Coincidentally, in 2011, the year in which some of these negotiations took place. Justin Kennedy, for the first time, was ranked on the New York Observer's, quote, 100 most powerful people in New York real estate at number 36. Donald Trump clocked in at number 12. The New York Observer was owned at the time by none other than Jared Kushner himself. So again, so far, Anthony Kennedy has Neil Gorsuch, who was appointed to the Supreme Court and has now been confirmed, as a law clerk. Trump nominates him. Brett Kavanaugh and Raymond Ketledge were the men that were named by a White House spokesman to be the candidates for the next Supreme Court vacancy. That vacancy came to pass when Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement. Both Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who is Trump's nominee, and Raymond F. Ketledge, the other candidate, had clerked for Anthony Kennedy. At the same time, Trump makes three appellate court judge nominations. Stephen Bibas, Michael Scooter, and Eric Murphy, all three of which have also clerked for Anthony Kennedy. Anthony Kennedy's son, Justin, was in charge of Deutsche Bank's global real estate investments at the time when Deutsche Bank alone would lay out billions of dollars to back up the Trump real estate operations at a time when other lending institutions would not touch the Donald with a 10-foot bleeping pole. Then Justin Kennedy, after heading up Deutsche Bank's global real estate deals, goes to work for as co-CEO of LNR Property, which then bails Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, out of a very sketchy investment, described by the New York Times as a risky investment in 2007, at a Midtown Manhattan aluminum clad tower. Again, for purposes of emphasis and clarification, that was not 666 Fifth Avenue. That was the address to which Jared Kushner moved the headquarters of his real estate operation. Also, in this time period, the New York Observer, owned by Jared Kushner, lists Justin Kennedy as one of the most influential people in New York real estate, and Donald Trump was number 12. Jared Kushner owned the New York Observer.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
More about the circumstances that led to Justice Kennedy's retirement. From Talking Points memo of July 10th of 2018 by Nicole LaFond, capital LaFond, it was always Kavanaugh. After meeting with Kennedy, Trump was set on his pick. It reads in part, while the White House was successful for the most part in keeping Donald Trump's Supreme Court pick under wraps for the past 2 weeks, Trump was essentially decided on his nominee after Justice Anthony Kennedy told him he would retire in a meeting, Politico reported. According to aides close to the White House who spoke to Politico, in that meeting, Kennedy recommended Trump pick Brett Kavanaugh, who had served as a former law clerk to Kennedy. While Trump was reportedly already interested in Kavanaugh before that discussion with Kennedy, the retiring jurist's recommendation helped seal the deal. And what we're going to talk about next is Gregory Kennedy. Gregory Kennedy also has links to Trump, as we will see, from the political blog of July 9th of 2018 by Christopher Cadelago, C-A-V-E-L-A-G-O, Nancy Cook, and Andrew Restuccia, R-E-S-T-U-C-C-I-A, how a private meeting with Kennedy helped Trump get to yes on Kavanaugh. After Justice Anthony Kennedy told President Donald Trump he would relinquish his seat on the Supreme Court, the president emerged from his private meeting with the retiring jurist focused on one candidate to name as his successor, Brett Kavanaugh, Kennedy's former law clerk. Trump, according to confidants and aides close to the White House, had become increasingly convinced that, quote, the judges, unquote, as he put it, or his administration's remaking of the federal judiciary in its conservative image, is central to his legacy as president. And he credits Kennedy, who spent more than a decade at the center of the power on the court, for giving him that opportunity. So even as Trump dispatched his top lawyers to comb through Kavanaugh's rulings and quiz allies about whether he was too close to the Bush family, potentially a fatal flaw, the president was always leaning toward accepting Kennedy's partiality for Kavanaugh while preserving the secret until his formal announcement, sources with knowledge of his thinking told Politico. Kennedy's seat, meantime, seemed destined to go to Kavanaugh, thanks in part to the glowing review of Kennedy, whose son, Justin, knows Donald Trump Jr. through New York real estate circles. Boy, there is an understatement. Knows Donald Trump Jr. through real estate circles. I'm tempted to comment on the relationship between Justin Kennedy, and Donald Trump in carnal terms that I could not use on the radio, but I will leave that to a listener's imagination. Who knows Donald Trump Jr.? Boy, does he ever, in the biblical sense, really. again, Justin Trump, head of Deutsche Bank's global real estate investments, and Donald Trump availing himself of just those services for a long time. And then Jared Kushner gets his little rear end bailed out by Justin Kennedy when he is co-CEO of LNR Properties. That is not the only link between the sons of Kennedy and Team Trump. I'm beginning again with that last sentence. That's the one I have a hard time reading without guffawing. Kennedy's seat, meantime, seemed destined to go to Kavanaugh, thanks in part to the glowing review of Kennedy, whose son, Justin, knows Donald Trump Jr. through New York real estate circles, and again, I think knows there would be in the biblical sense, and whose other adult child has connections to Trump world via the president's 2016 Silicon Valley advisor, Peter Thiel. Most recently, when the Kennedy firm Disruptive Technology Advisors worked with Thiel's Palantir Technologies. And more about that. We're going to take a look at Peter Thiel. Now, we have looked at Peter Thiel at great length in many programs. We first looked at him in For the Record 718, done on Independence Day weekend of 2010. Peter Thiel helped to capitalize Facebook. He sits on Facebook's board of directors. He was at one time its largest stockholder, although now he has sold much of his stock. He is now, at last check, was the seventh biggest investor in Facebook. Peter Thiel also is involved with many other companies. He was part of the PayPal mafia, as they call it, and he has a tech firm, Palantir Technologies, by the way, the largest holder of real estate properties in the largest renter of real estate in the city of Palo Alto. Palantir Technologies is heavily involved with surveillance. They hold many contracts with the NSA and the CIA. They have a counterterror software called PRISM. I personally believe that that is the same PRISM that was one of the major features of the Edward Snowden documents. Palantir has denied that. What we are supposed to believe is that Palantir has a counterterror program called PRISM, which just happens to share the same name as the PRISM technology that was at the focal point, was a focal point of the Snowden documentation. As we've looked at, there are also two other counter-terror software programs called PRISM, one of which is used by German intelligence and the other of which is used by NATO in Afghanistan. Supposedly, none of them have anything to do with one another. So we are supposed to believe that Palantir's PRISM counterterror software and a contract with NSA and CIA has nothing to do with the PRISM counterterror software at the center of the Snowden documentation, and that two other PRISM counterterror software programs, one used by Germany, one used by NATO, have no connection to any of the others. As I've noted, these big Silicon Valley firms are nothing if not litigious. I think it is extraordinarily unlikely that these are four separate counterterror software programs that just happen to share the same name. But again, it certainly is understandable that after the Snowden documentation became public, none of them would want to be publicly affiliated with that for PR reasons.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Again, in one of our shows called The Gruppenhobbit, this is one of the Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook programs in the 700s. I think it was 768, but I may be wrong. We looked at the Palantir firm. We looked at it in other programs as well. We will come back to it. From the Politico blog of April 6th of 2017 by Shane Goldmacher, G-O-L-D-M-A-C-H-E-R, Trump's hidden back channel to Justice Kennedy, their kids, skipping down. Another is to Kennedy's other son, Gregory, and Trump's Silicon Valley advisor, Peter Thiel. They went to Stanford Law School together and served as president of the Federalist Society in back-to-back years, according to school records. By the way, the Federalist Society is a very powerful conservative judicial institution. They have made many of the recommendations that have become appointments and nominee and confirmed appointments by not only Trump but others. This Federalist Society would have been at Stanford Law School. Continuing, more recently, Kennedy's firm Disruptive Technology Advisors has worked with Thiel's company Palantir Technologies. In fact, during the early months of the Trump administration, Gregory Kennedy has worked at NASA as a senior financial advisor as part of the so-called beefhead team. I don't know what he would have been doing, but Palantir Technologies is heavily involved in surveillance, counterterror, and intelligence-related technologies. I just wonder off the top of my head if any of that had anything to do with reconnaissance satellites. Now, again, Palantir and Gregory Kennedy's Disruptive Technology Advisors have some interesting dealings. Perhaps the most interesting potential dealing concerns allegations in a major lawsuit against Palantir. As far as I know, this has not been completely adjudicated, so I will refer to the charges by KT4 Partners as allegations. I don't believe that this lawsuit has yet to complete adjudication. But from BuzzFeed News of March 17th of 2017, we have the following article by William Alden, A-L-D-E-N. A Silicon Valley giant blocked its investors from selling their shares, lawsuit claims. Palantir Technologies, one of the most valuable startups in Silicon Valley, has deprived investors of basic information about its business and repeatedly hindered efforts by investors to sell their shares, according to a blistering lawsuit filed by a longtime investor in the firm. In addition to keeping at least some shareholders in the dark about its financial performance, Palantir has, quote, engaged in a pattern and practice, unquote, of attempting to thwart their attempts to sell stock, according to the lawsuit filed by investment firm KT4 Partners. That's Kangaroo Thomas 4 Partners. Instead of letting these investors sell shares, Palantir has steered their sale opportunities to itself or its executives while showering a favored brokerage firm with commissions, even when the firm does no work at all, the lawsuit alleges. KT4 Partners first bought Palantir shares over a decade ago and is seeking to compel Palantir to hand over financial records, which it says are needed to understand the value of its investment. Further, KT4 claims it needs this information to investigate whether Palantir or its executives had engaged in, quote, improper and illegal conduct, unquote, to harm minority shareholders. The lawsuit was filed under seal last week in the Delaware Court of Chancery. A partially redacted version was released on Monday and is reported here for the first time. Skipping down. Co-founded in 2004 by the billionaire Peter Thiel, who is now advising President Donald Trump, Palantir analyzes data for government agencies and major corporations. It has a $20 billion valuation, making it the third most highly valued startup in Silicon Valley, behind only Uber and Airbnb. Yet Palantir, whose stock changes hands only through private trades, goes to great lengths to keep any detailed information about its business private. A report by BuzzFeed News last year gave an unprecedented, though limited, account of its commercial operations. The lawsuit, a highly unusual step for a startup investor, follows efforts by KT4 to obtain business information through other means. KT4 made a written demand last August to inspect Palantir's books and records, the lawsuit says, but then, according to the lawsuit, Palantir retroactively amended its investors' rights agreement, quote, for the sole and express purpose, unquote, of avoiding disclosure obligations. Skipping down, Palantir is under increasing pressure from its shareholders, a number of whom have held its stock for a decade or more and are anxiously awaiting a payday. Former employees who received a major part of their pay in stock options have struggled to cash out despite limited share purchase offers arranged by the company. Last fall, in a reversal of his long-time refusal to purchase an IPO, Palantir's CEO Alex Karp said at a tech conference, quote, we're now positioning the company so we could go public, unquote. This statement by Karp, by the way, an attendee at the Bilderberg conference in the Netherlands, has a previously undisclosed, that's my interjection beginning again, this statement by CEO Alex Karp of Palantir has a previously undisclosed backstory according to the lawsuit. KT4 says it came after a formal request by the investor for information on whether Palantir had considered an IPO. KT4 says its stake in Palantir is worth over $60 million, a significant sum by many measures, but small in the context of Palantir, which has raised more than $2 billion from investors. When KT4 tried to sell portions of the stake, Palantir repeatedly interfered, the lawsuit claims. Palantir, following a common practice in Silicon Valley, requires that any sellers of its stock seek the company's approval for the transaction. Companies do this to limit and manage ownership of their shares. But remarkably, KT4 claims that when Palantir receives information from an investor about a planned sale, it uses that information to contact the buyer and persuade them instead to buy shares directly from the company or from certain Palantir insiders instead. One particular broker, Disruptive Technology Advisors, or DTA, by the way, headed by Gregory Kennedy, repeatedly gets commissions from these sales even when it, quote, performed no legitimate work, unquote, KT4 claims. Again, DTA, Disruptive Technology Advisors, headed by Gregory Kennedy. One more time, this last sentence. One particular broker, Disruptive Technology Advisors, or DTA, repeatedly gets commissions from these sales, even when it, quote, performed no legitimate work, K. KT4 claims. KT4 says it experienced interference by Palantir when it tried to sell shares to Highbridge Capital Management, a hedge fund that was owned by J.P. Morgan Chase, in May of 2015. After KT4 notified Palantir of the planned sale, Palantir turned around and instructed Disruptive Technology advisors to, quote, take the opportunity on Palantir's behalf, unquote, and arrange a sale from Palantir to Highbridge instead, according to the lawsuit. But when Alex Fishman, a founder of BTA, met with a senior managing director at Highbridge, the hedge fund executive said he would not break his deal with KT4, telling Fishman to leave his office, according to the lawsuit. The situation escalated when Karp, the Palantir CEO, learned of Highbridge's affiliation with J.P. Morgan, a very important customer of Palantir's, and that the bank's CEO, Jamie Dimon, quote, would be asked to contact Karp directly to express displeasure at these tactics. The point being that Disruptive Technology Advisors is apparently the go-to firm on the inside, and I mean inside track, for Palantir. Continuing and skipping down. Even when the DTA, when Disruptive Technology Advisors, was not involved in the deal, it still could get paid according to KT4. Last summer, when UBS Securities was brokering a sale of Palantir shares, Karp demanded that UBS pay 25 cents a share, UBS, that's Union Bank of Switzerland, pay 25 cents a share to Fishman and DTA, even though Disruptive Technology Advisors, quote, had performed no work on the transaction, and UBS, that's Union Bank of Switzerland, another major Bormann bank, and UBS agreed to make the payment, the lawsuit says. KT4 says it learned from a UBS managing director, but in an interview, KT4 says it learned this from a UBS managing director, but in an interview with BuzzFeed News, a person close to the UBS disputed that the bank participated in such a sale. And so, interesting place here for Disruptive Technology Advisors to turn up. Very quickly, with regard, since this is in the context of Justice Anthony Kennedy's successors, Peter Thiel went to law school with Gregory Kennedy. Very quickly, a couple of the key features of Peter Thiel's legal orientation. Again, he is a lawyer. As we looked at in, for the record, number 718, from a Bloomberg.com story from Canadian Hedge Watch by Deepak Gopinath, G-O-P-I-N-A-T-H, from December 4th of 2006. PayPal's Thiel scores 230% gain with Soros-style fund. After collecting his law degree, Thiel clerked for U.S. federal court judge Larry Edmondson in Atlanta and then joined Sullivan and Cromwell LLP in New York. So Peter Thiel went for his first work for a law firm was with Sullivan and Cromwell, the old Dulles law firm that has been deeply involved not only with Bormann Network Investments but channeled money to help capitalize. And John Foster Dulles helped to put IG Farben together. Alan Dulles, deeply involved with many of the investments in the Third Reich by powerful Wall Street people, including the Bush family. And Alan Dulles also helped with the Bormann Flight Capital Organization and the overlapping Reinhard-Galen spy outfit. Another interesting note about some of the legal influences on Peter Thiel from San Francisco Magazine of November 29th of 2017, Peter Thiel's Apocalypse by Scott Lucas. And talking about some of the legal influences on Peter Thiel. Thiel turns to German legal scholar Carl Schmitt, S-C-H-M-I-T-T, a brilliant thinker who was also a Nazi and the Third Reich's preeminent legal theorist. For Thiel, Schmitt is an inspiring throwback to a pre-Enlightenment age who exalts struggle and insists that the discovery of enemies is the foundation of politics. So again, a key legal influence on Peter Thiel, who began his legal career, such as it was, with Sullivan and Cromwell, is the top legal strategist or legal theorist for the Third Reich, also a major figure for the Conservativa Revolution, as we have looked at in the past. Note that Thiel is of German extraction. His father was a chemical engineer from Frankfurt, Germany. As is the case with Deutsche Bank, IG Farben had Frankfurt as a capital, as an main operating base, and the member companies of what was IG Farben are major players on the contemporary chemical scene, as we have looked at in For the Record 912 and 1012 as well. Now, Palantir was also deeply involved with Cambridge Analytica, its parent company, SCL, and their use of Facebook technology. Bear in mind that Peter Thiel, in addition to being one of the driving people behind Palantir, is also on the board of directors of Facebook, helped capitalize Facebook, and was at one time its largest shareholder. And Palantir Technologies played a significant, albeit unofficial, role with the Cambridge Analytica use of Facebook data to gain the 2016 election. We looked at this in For the Record 946, among other programs. A New York Times story from March 27th of 2018 by Nicholas Confessore, C-O-N-F-E-S-S-O-R-E, and Matthew Rosenberg. Spy contractors' idea, that's Palantir of Peter Thiel, and linked with disruptive technology advisors of Gregory Kennedy, spy contractors' idea helped Cambridge Analytica harvest Facebook data. As a startup called Cambridge Analytica sought to harvest the Facebook data of tens of millions of Americans in the summer of 2014, the company received help from at least one employee at Palantir Technologies, a top Silicon Valley contractor to American spy agencies, and the Pentagon. It was a Palantir employee in London working closely with the data scientists building Cambridge's psychological profiling technology, who suggested the scientists create their own app, a mobile phone-based personality quiz, to gain access to Facebook users' friend networks, according to documents obtained by the New York Times. Skipping down. The revelations pulled Palantir, co-founded by the wealthy libertarian Peter Thiel, into the furor surrounding Cambridge, which improperly obtained Facebook data to build analytical tools it deployed on behalf of Donald J. Trump and other Republican candidates in 2016. Mr. Thiel, a supporter of President Trump, serves on the board at Facebook. Quote, there were senior Palantir employees that were also working on the Facebook data, unquote, said Christopher Wiley, a data expert and Cambridge Analytica co-founder, in testimony before British lawmakers on Tuesday. Skipping down. The connections between Palantir and Cambridge Analytica were thrust into the spotlight by Mr. Wiley's testimony on Tuesday. Both companies are linked to tech-driven billionaires who backed Mr. Trump's campaign. Cambridge is chiefly owned by Robert Mercer, the computer scientist and hedge fund magnate, while Palantir was co-founded in 2003 by Mr. Thiel, who was an early initial investor in Facebook. Skipping down. A former intern at SCL, Sophie Schmidt, the daughter of Eric Schmidt, then Google's executive chairman, urged the company to link up with Palantir, according to Mr. Wiley's testimony and a June 2013 email viewed by The Times. Ever come across Palantir? Amusingly, Eric Schmidt's daughter was an intern with us and is trying to push us towards them, one SCL employee wrote to a colleague in the mail. But Wiley says some Palantir employees helped engineer Cambridge's psychographic models. Quote, there were Palantir staff who would come into the office and work on the data, Mr. Wiley told lawmakers, and we would go and meet with Palantir staff at Palantir. He did not provide an exact number for the employees or identify them. So it certainly appears that Palantir, Team Kennedy, Team Trump, Peter Thiel, is one big and apparently relatively happy family. This concludes For the Record program number 1017, Supreme Court Trump Card, Family Trump, Family Kennedy, and Peter Thiel. This is being recorded on July 31st of 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.